having testosterone deficiency, it's literally soul destroying from a standpoint that you have no energy. You cannot think clearly. You have horrifying brain fog. Most men, you know, and this is where a lot of confusion comes in, but most men, the number one symptom of a testosterone deficiency is brain fog. And so by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they have this like feeling of like, I want to go home and take a nap. And so the worst part about all of this is, again, because there's such a lack of recognition in the physician community around the world, when they do go to the doctors write them prescriptions for SSRI inhibitors, you know, mood altering medications and stuff like that. And then at the same time, they'll also normally complain that they have sexual dysfunction, because that's obviously a side effect too. And then so they'll write them a prescription for an erectile dysfunction. So what ends up happening is you have the physician community writing prescriptions for erectile dysfunction and brain, you know, mood alterations, you know, to get rid of their quote unquote depression or their brain fog. Because a lot of the times they report it as they're depressed too. And so the root core issue, which is obviously the testosterone deficiency, is never even being addressed.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of Future Skills, where we prepare you for an uncertain future of accelerating change. I am Ludvig Sundström, your host, together with Mikael Syding. Today, our guest is Jay Campbell. Jay is an expert on fitness and hormonal optimization, and he's written the leading book on testosterone replacement therapy, which is called The Testosterone Optimization Bible. In this episode, we'll go over some of the many myths and the truths about testosterone, estrogen, and other hormones, according to what the latest science has to say about it. We start out talking about how a kick to the groin changed Jay's life dramatically when he was just 29, leaving him with deficient testosterone levels, and how he recovered from that and kept playing basketball at a high level and also retained a very successful modeling career, where recently he's appeared on the cover of Iron Man magazine. Then after that, we get into the nitty-gritty details, like the practical details of benchmarks for health and hormonal levels, and what diagnostic tests it might make sense to do if you have a problem. Among other things, we find out three of the most important testosterone-related metrics to keep track of as a healthy man. Who should do their blood work and how often? And if your numbers are bad, what is the number one thing, the most important preventive measure that you can take immediately? So, let's hear what Jay has to say about this. Thanks for being here, Jay.
Hey, I appreciate you guys having me on your show.
So let's go a little bit into your background, because you're an entrepreneur in real estate, and you've been into the real estate area for a pretty long time, right?
Yes, I've been actively in real estate, working in sales and managing a sizable team in Southern California for about 6 years now. But prior to that, I was involved in real estate and just being a landlord, owning multiple investment properties. And that went on, you know, to this date, it's more than 20 years.
Yeah. I remember you told me about that once. And on the side of doing all this, you've also always been really into fitness. But I never really understood how you got started with that. Could you maybe tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So my background in college is I played basketball in Division II basketball in the United States at a school called Georgia Southwestern University, which is in America's Georgia. I was a very decorated high school basketball player. So I was always an athlete. I was always into the conditioning phase of, you know, maintaining great physical condition and staying in great shape. And I was turned on at the end of my college basketball career to a good friend of mine where I went to school into training with weights. And, you know, I just had like a love for it immediately. I gravitated toward it immediately. And then in my 20s, I moved out to California after I graduated from college, and I tried to get into, I shouldn't say tried, I actually did. I got into modeling and acting. I did some small roles in some movies, but I gravitated towards modeling because I just had the naturally long, lean physique. And so I did a bunch of stuff. I was on some covers of magazines in my mid-20s. I kept playing competitive basketball. I never had taken anything other than, you know, the typical mid-20s guy who's focused on fitness from a supplementation standpoint, you know, testosterone boosters, creatine, you know, whatever, whey protein, mega mass protein powders, all that stuff in my 20s. At 29, I was playing basketball in a very competitive league, and I got kicked in the testicles. And most people who know this know my story pretty well. Between 3 to 6 weeks later, I started feeling run down, and I just thought I was like, you know, close to 30 years old. I was a month out. It was actually in January when I was 29 and I turned 30 in February. And so I was lucky. I went to a primary care physician and he recommended that we do some tests and sent me to an endocrinologist. And the guy actually, the endocrinologist was named Dr. Raymond Scruggs. He was a brilliant guy, Harvard educated. He worked out of the New Hope Health Clinic in Orange County, California. And he said, let's run your testosterone. And again, at that time in my life at 29, I really didn't know much about that. I was kind of weirded out. I was like, well, why would I need to do that? And he said, just trust me. And so he did. And my score came back, you know, subclinical, literally below 300. I don't remember what it was. It was somewhere in the range of like 230 to 270. And so he's like, look, I want to put you on testosterone prescription. And so, you know, I talked to my wife at the time. She's long gone. That was my first wife. And she was kind of reluctant, but, you know, I'd read about it and he's a brilliant guy. So I said, let's do it. So 4 weeks later,
you said you were around maybe let's say 250, just to pick a number. And what is normal? What should you have, or what is the lowest clinical normal level?
So it's a good question. The standard mean deviation. So what that means when I said 250 to 270 is in nanograms per deciliter, and that's a measurement of total testosterone. There's unfortunately in the world right now, there really is not like a standard curve of how people measure testosterone. There's multiple companies measuring testosterone. And then there's also differentiation between like Europe and North America. And outside of those two places, there's really nobody measuring testosterone. But to answer that question, they just lowered last year LabCorp, which is kind of the big, most important, or at least the most well-known measurement company, lowered the standard mean deviation by 120 points. Now they say they lowered it. This is across all lab measurement numbers from men who had their testosterone measured because of the incidence, the worldwide prevalence of obesity and insulin resistance, which is actually lowering men's testosterone scores by that nature. Now, again, that's their statement. In my newest book, which is the Testosterone Optimization Therapy Bible, we have a chapter totally dedicated on this entire concept of what is called the new normal, which is the lowering of the standard mean deviation. But right now across the board, if you're considered subclinical, which means you're low testosterone or deficient in testosterone when you are below 300 nanograms per deciliter. And again, that's a measurement of total testosterone. The other measurement that they look at is what is known as free testosterone, which is the measurement of the bioavailable testosterone in your bloodstream. So testosterone, not to get into super esoteric discussion, is bound up in the blood, and your free testosterone is the unbound testosterone, which makes the most readily able to be used by the body. Again, that's why it's called bio-T or free testosterone. So those two scores are important. A lot of times men who have low levels, subclinical levels, like in the 350, 400 range, they're not considered low by their doctor because, again, they're not below the 300 mean, but they actually could have very low free testosterone, which is indicative of a testosterone deficiency because the testosterone they do have, which obviously is already on the low end, is not really being available. It's so bound up, it's not available to be used by the body.
Right. So you need both of these to be positive about it.
It would be good to not be considered deficient. You should have a specific level. And again, I can't really give a level because across the world, you know, the way they measure this is different. So it would be confusing. But like in North America, if you use a LabCorp score, you want to have like a free testosterone score somewhere of the range of 14 to 20 naturally to look good. And then again, over 300. But here's the thing, guys. The measurement numbers are meaningless. Okay, any good clinician, which is obviously a physician that understands how to manage a man's endocrine system, is going to be administering a clinical diagnosis, and a clinical diagnosis is, you know, how many symptoms are you suffering from? And again, in that book, the Testosterone Optimization Therapy Bible, which is totbible.com, anyone can read it. And again, if you're a listener of your guys' show, and you send me an email to j@trtrevolution.com, I will send you a copy of the book for free, a PDF copy. I'm not going to mail you a copy of the book too.
That's really great. So just we'll put your email in the show notes. So you'll probably get quite a few emails. So just be prepared.
Oh, no problem. I give away the book. I've given thousands of copies away already. That's what I do. But the reality is that it's a very confusing topic. I'm glad you guys have me on the show today to really try to, you know, clear this up, because very intelligent men across the world are confused. confused by this. And then it's really compounded, gentlemen, because most of the physicians that are trying to look at this really have a very poor understanding of all of this, because there's no standard patient of care model in medicine accepted today anywhere.
How about if we take both of these measurements? So you've already given what's a low number that's bad, which is like below 300 total and below 14 free. But then if you take the upper level, the upper bounds, if you have really high in both, like when do you get too much? Can it be dangerous to have too high in both?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, naturally speaking, I don't think it's possible. I mean, again, everybody is biochemically unique and individual. So there are men, and these are very, very, very rare and few and far between today, but they are definitely men walking around on the planet today that I would consider outliers, who have natural levels of testosterone above 1,000. Okay, now if you're one of these people, and there have been some genetic, I wouldn't say genetic, but there's some like ethnicities, like the Sardinian men. There's some other studies with some men, I think the Basques, where they have like really high natural testosterone levels. A lot of Mediterranean, like Italian, Sicilian men, a lot of those guys also have very high natural testosterone levels. But by and large today, and again, this is all very, very well explained in the book. If you live in a large coastal population center that's, you know, full of modernized living debris, particulates in the air, all of these things, they are whacking, absolutely taking a beating to men's natural testosterone levels. So Ludwig, a good testosterone level today for a man, you know, in their low to mid 20s is over 650, like between 650 and 800. Like I look at Alexander Juan Antonio Cortez, who's 28, and he's very open about his writing on Twitter. And I know you guys know each other and stuff, but he gets his test done twice a year. And I think his last test, he was like 740. And that is really, really high. And Alex has really good genetics. You know, he has very good lineage. He obviously takes care of himself. He eats well, he trains. But that's very high. I mean, the average guy walking around the streets today, even in fit condition, is sub 500. And again, that's just because of the war that's going on right now in our environment.
I think we can get into this a bit more later, but I think this might be extra bad and problematic if you're in the US, because you guys have such a, you know, crazy food industry and stuff like
yes.
that. Whereas
you're
if you
right.
take a country
right.
like Sweden or certain other Scandinavian countries, you can trust that the quality of food is pretty high and you're not going to eat, you know, put crazy crap and chemicals in your body, like in Thailand, for example. And, you know, obviously that's going to mess you up a lot over time
well,
if you don't know about it.
You're 100% right. And actually in the book, there's a study, and we talk about this on Twitter all the time with all the physicians that I network with and work with, called the Hebrew University Study. And you can Google this. Anybody who's listening to the show can Google this and watch this. But it's the best study ever. It was a study over close to 30 years. It started in the mid-70s, and it went to like 2011. And they looked at men from every continent. And their conclusion, and this was actually not released, this research wasn't published and released until July of last year in 2017, was that it's so bad from an environmental standpoint, not just, you know, obviously the United States, you're right, is horrible, but just continentally, they predict that by the year 2045, that based on current rates of decline of males' testosterone levels and sperm count, that men will be wholly infertile, that as a from a global mean, that by 2045, if things are not changed and people don't, you know, start looking at this, that the average man will be walking around on the streets infertile. It's pretty insane.
That's an insane trend.
That's actually an HBO series right now. Did you know that? It's called The Handmaid's Tale.
I know that there's some people out there that are doing stuff about it, but I mean, again, in the mainstream, like in the United States, it's not even talked about. It's almost
this is like an ordinary TV series where the premise is that in the future, the fertility levels have shrunk so much that the human population is dying, and they're, well, going through various immoral ways of trying to make it work anyway.
That's awesome. I need to check that show out. Thanks for telling me that. Yeah, so there you go. I mean, Hollywood's already the entertainment industry's already forecasting it too.
And on the flip side of that, you have the fact that female hormones are increasing. Like women are getting into puberty and becoming pregnant faster historically in the last like 50 or 100 years compared to 200, 300, 400 years ago.
That is 100% accurate. And that's a good point. Let's put this in here. So if you measure the average man walking around on the streets, testosterone levels in the 40s, right? The World War II generation. This is not an exaggeration. Again, this is all backed up in the book. They would be on average 2.5 times higher than the average man walking around today on the streets. I mean, so you think about that. So if you put that into the numbers, the average guy was 850 to 950. And today the guys in the low 200s, to the early mid 300s. And remember, the standard mean deviation was lowered 126 points. So it's even worse when you really look at it. So it's a crisis. It's an epidemic, however you want to label it. And again, as I continue to say, and all the people that follow me say, this is an unrecognized, an epidemic to the medical industry or the medical community or the sick care, industry that we call it.
So what are the negative effects of having too low testosterone levels?
It's a great question. So it's soul crushing. I mean, literally, I don't know. I could give you some quotes from the book, just kind of reiterate them. But some of the best doctors say that having testosterone deficiency, and there's a lot of different clinical terms for it now. They call it partial androgen deficiency, testosterone deficiency, type 2 hypogonadism. There's a lot of different names that they've come up with now in the clinical community setting. But it's it's literally soul destroying from a standpoint that you have no energy, you cannot think clearly. You have horrifying brain fog. Most men, and this is where a lot of confusion comes in, but most men, the number one symptom of a testosterone deficiency is brain fog. And so by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they have this like feeling of like, I want to go home and take a nap. And so the worst part about all of this is, again, because there's such a lack of recognition in the physician community around the world, when they do go to the doctors write them prescriptions for SSRI inhibitors, mood altering medications and stuff like that. And then at the same time, they'll also normally complain that they have sexual dysfunction because that's obviously a side effect too. They'll write them a prescription for an erectile dysfunction. So what ends up happening is you have the physician community writing prescriptions for erectile dysfunction and brain, mood alterations, to get rid of their quote unquote depression or their brain fog. Cause a lot of the times they report it as they're depressed too. And so the root core issue, which is obviously the testosterone deficiency, is never even being addressed.
Could this be a question of simply sleeping too little? I mean, even if sleeping too little maybe reduces your testosterone, could that be the root cause?
No, it's definitely not the root cause, but for sure, 100%. And again, I'll default to the book. Alexander Juan Antonio Cortez, helped. Well, he actually wrote a couple of chapters and then was one of the master editors of the book. But we have an article that we link to. It's an amazing article. Highly recommend all of your listeners read this article. But it's 50 ways to optimize natural testosterone production. And I helped him write it. But it goes into the ways that a human being on the streets today, regardless of whether you live in like the wilds, 500 miles away from population and civilization, or if you live in a 10 million city like LA, you can optimize your natural testosterone levels. And sleep degradation is a huge issue in society today, because as you guys know, technology, entrepreneurialism, internet marketing, all of this stuff is like, like my business partner, Joshua Smith, is, his model is get shit done, right? So it's like everybody wants to work, nonstop, 18 hours a day. So sleep degradation is a huge issue, and it definitely causes a lot of problems. It can definitely cause, a lowering of testosterone levels. It can disrupt thyroid. It can disrupt melatonin, pituitary gland function. There's a lot of things that it can do, but it's definitely not the number one cause of testosterone deficiency. No one really knows the etiology, but I can definitely tell you that if you were going to put a gun to my head, I would say that it's fourfold. Okay. It's number one, it's the younger kids today, especially younger males, do not exercise enough. Okay. They're playing video games. They sit there, they do nothing. They're Ludwig already hit the nail right on the head. In westernized countries, they eat absolute shit food. They're eating nothing but GMO food, totally engineered crap food that's not designed for their digestive systems to even handle. And then the other two things are clearly, and these could be, you could flip-flop these, but the other things are xenoestrogens, phthalates, BPA, all of these horrifying endocrine disrupting chemicals that you guys also mentioned about when you talked about women, reaching puberty earlier, right? Because it's all the same thing. There's like 100 studies on PubMed right now that anybody could pull up that shows what birth control medications have actually done to the water supply. I mean, there's just so much crap that's in our environment now that to me, it's very difficult, unless you're a type A personality, again, and we talk about this in the book, to fully optimize your hormone levels without considering optimization. And obviously optimization would be through medicinal means, through therapeutic testosterone, or, through the natural means, which again is very difficult. And also there's a genetic component, because there's a lot of guys that can do everything right. They just don't have the genetic, the real genetics to stay optimized. And I deal with a lot of those guys. I consult with a lot of those guys. You know, there's a lot of very productive men who reach out to me, and I look into their lifestyle, and they're doing every single thing right, and they still have 300 tests.
Okay, so what you should do is exercise, and maybe stay away from city water, and sleep well. And are there some other natural remedies for testosterone deficiency?
There, for sure. You can definitely eat a low carb diet. You can definitely fast. I know Ludwig is a big faster. Obviously I've written a book on fasting myself. It's an amazing thing. There's a lot of great things that come from fasting. I think there's a million things that you can do naturally to optimize, but I hearken back, and obviously I don't want to sound like a shill because I'm pro testosterone, but one of the top physicians in the world who's has a very vocal point in the testosterone optimization therapy Bible, he puts it in a mathematical component. He says it like this: if you're 50 years old and older, the odds of you being able to stay optimized naturally through natural means, again, there's numerous ways to try to do it, are less than 5%. So he's saying essentially you're one out of, between five out of 100 guys, okay? If you're 30 and older trying to stay optimized, he says it's 20 out of 100. But he has the caveat that says that if you are one of those five or one of those 20 in those different age groups, you have to be an absolute type A personality. So he's like, you have to decide if you are willing to put in all of that work and all of that effort to try to remain optimized, through natural means versus, considering using medicinal means because it's easier and more convenient. But again, it's always a choice for everybody. Clearly, you guys know when you go on testosterone, it's a lifelong decision because you're replacing your body's, I hate using that word replacing. That's why we use optimizing. But you are going to be dependent on the body's exogenous source now.
So one downside, if you will, is that once you start supplementing testosterone, then, you have to follow that road.
Correct. I don't like to use the word downsize. Because I think it diminishes it or demeans it, because a lot of men get scared. And as we know in the world today, too many people are fearful for nothing. But I look at it as, what are your choices, right? So, and all of this is very, very, very well elucidated in the book. And I think it's chapter 5 or 6, when we look at the ethical component of doing this and the lifelong, requirement. You can either get old with low testosterone and suffer the massive decline, which again is very much laid out in the book, and it's multifactorial, and it's not a life you want to live. Or you could decide, that you want to be self actualizing and obviously, proactive, and decide that you're going to do this. The issue to me is not whether or not one should consider it. It's just whether one has access financially, and also to the best physicians, because you cannot do this without having access to people who are really, really smart, who can guide you and mentor this. Because again, guys, the reality of testosterone optimization therapy is it's new.
I think we're also jumping ahead a little bit, because the way that I see it is that if you want to go that step and do testosterone optimization therapy, then that's really for older guys usually, or people who have a really big problem. But if you take
Ludwig, you're incorrect. You're absolutely incorrect. Yeah, that's not correct. Right now, this is, again, the reality of this is, this is an issue that is affecting more than 40% of men across the board at every age. So can men fix this naturally? 100%. Can a 22-year-old person, should a 22 to 25-year-old person consider going on testosterone? No, absolutely not.
That's really what I want to go into.
Yeah, no. But I just want you to understand that, or I want it to be clear, that it's still a choice that many men are going to have to make, because even if they do try to naturally optimize testosterone, it's going to fail. And that's where the best physicians are coming into play right now, and trying to educate the physicians that aren't understanding, because the biggest increase right now in testosterone prescriptions worldwide is in men under the age of 30. So that's what's so scary. So it's like, I don't want guys to listen to the show and think, well, oh, you know what, I'm 26, it doesn't matter for me. Because those are the guys, a lot of those guys are suffering. So I didn't want to cut you off or disagree with you. I just want guys to understand that you definitely have to get your blood work done.
Right, that's fine. I definitely do agree with that when it comes to getting your blood work done. And I do that myself like 2-3 times a year, and not just testosterone,
but
different other metrics too.
All right, so step by step, how should an average guy proceed? I've actually never had my testosterone gauged. And I'm 46, so what should I do?
I mean, it's a good question. I mean, we recommend that as soon as you have the financial means to get your blood work done, and obviously the wherewithal to understand your blood work, there's numerous ways to go on YouTube and read. I mean, I've got multiple videos online of showing people how to measure their blood work. I'm actually doing a podcast with a guy who has like 1.5 million YouTube subscribers next week, and it's going to be live, and we're going to break down his blood work. And he's 1 year younger than you. Same thing. He's actually just starting to go on testosterone because he was diagnosed with like 160 or something like that. But it's a good question. It just depends. Obviously I speak about North America for the most part, but in North America, there's multiple private medical companies that do not require any man or woman to have a prescription from a doctor, and they can just literally do it online. Private MD labs, discountedlabs.com, couple companies that I'm going to be working with and possibly have equity stakes in, BodMD, BodHD. There's just numerous options. Now in the international community, unfortunately, this is still not, we're not there. Like even in the UK, where Daniel Kelly, I've been mentoring him for 5 years. He works for like balancemyhormones.net, which is a really big deal in London. It's still broken. I mean, there's still not a lot of private options. And then for you guys, again, you know, because America's different with managed care and, you know, there's no socialized medicine here. It's also difficult because like in socialized medicine in most countries, no one is doing this. So you can't just go to a physician and say, hey, doctor, I want you to measure my testosterone levels. They're going to look at you like you're nuts. You know, they're going to be like, well, why would I do that? So that's probably the reason why you, as smart as you are at 46, no one's ever told you to do it, because it's just, again, it's not a standard patient of care model. It's not something where they come into the office and you say, open up and say, and they, you know, search your back and look for your breathing and all that and check your pulse. At some point, in my opinion, that, you know, this will get to a point where you get 25, maybe 24, where they'll say, okay, let's get your blood work done. We want to look at your hormone levels. Because again, I mean, we already know that, you know, infertility is the direction that we're headed right now.
Okay, I want to ask you something about the metrics being used, like the different metrics used to gain a sense of the steroid cycle. And you already mentioned total testosterone and free testosterone. And we've established that if you have under 250 or something like that in total, and under 14, and you have under that in both, then you
actually,
have...
The Endocrine Society just changed it the other day, literally. Like it came out, I think, Monday of this week, and their standard diagnosis is 300 nanograms per deciliter total. So when you're sub 300, they'll allow testosterone.
All right. So the lowest that I've ever been is, I think, 450 or something like that. And then I've actually increased it quite a lot. However, then you also have the free testosterone, and that's only decreased a little bit, not so much. But then you also have to take into account estrogen, right? So
correct.
How important is the TE, testosterone divided by estrogen metric?
Great question. It's crucial. Today in society, and again, this goes back to why it's very important that younger men do get this measured. Again, because of the xenoestrogens, and you know, I call it the environmental war that's being waged from modernized living. A lot of men walking around on the streets today, and women, are estrogen dominant. And when you're estrogen dominant, you present physically as soft, low, almost no muscle tone, a lot of upper you know, regional adiposity, which is like fat in the upper back. You know, somebody put this on Twitter the other day. They said that you walk around any modernized city today and you look at human beings from behind and you really can't differentiate, the average man and woman. And that's a perfect, indictment of estrogen dominance. Because
yeah,
again,
it's like gynecomastia.
Yeah, well, exactly. It's everywhere. That's everywhere. We have a whole chapter on gynecomastia in the book. But that's a whole other topic. Don't even get me going on that. But that's exactly a part and parcel to the estrogen dominance. So when your estrogen is out of control, and you know, you talked about the T to E ratio or the balance of testosterone to estrogen in the goal of therapeutic testosterone. So testosterone optimization therapy, it's a twofold goal. And any really qualified, experienced clinician understands this. Number one is you're seeking balance between testosterone and estrogen. And then the second of the goal is happiness or well-being. So you're improving the person's well-being. They feel good about themselves. So you cannot, there's no possible way that anybody walking around society today, especially men, can function optimally when their estrogen levels are so out of whack. Now, there are no... We talk about this in the book. There's been some really strong and great urologists who've done research and, offered studies. And, some of them have tried to say that your testosterone, one of the guys, I forget his name, he's a famous urologist out of Houston, Texas. He tried to say that it should be 10 to 1, that your testosterone level should be, 10 times that of estrogen. That in clinical practice, that never comes out because a lot of men just overproduce estrogen genetically. And again, that's an esoteric conversation, but there's an enzyme in the human body called aromatase, and that's what converts testosterone to estrogen in the human body. And some men just overproduce aromatase. The fatter you are, the more obese or the higher your body fat is, you will also produce more aromatase because that's where aromatase actually lives in adipose tissue. So, to answer your question or go back to your point specifically, you don't want to be estrogen dominant as a man, okay? It's going to lower your sex drive. It's going to make you obviously way less masculine. You're going to be less decisive. I mean, it's going to affect you. I mean, it's similar to being, deficient in testosterone as a 50-year-old guy, the comparison would be a 50-year-old man who's, clinical, subclinical, 200 level testosterone, 150 testosterone would be the same as a 20-year-old boy who has, estrogen in the 90s or 80s. Okay. Again, I'm just using the grade scale of the United States.
Right. Okay. So would you maybe say that the most important thing, the most important preventive step that people can do, men, is that they can try to lower their estrogen levels if possible?
Totally. Absolutely. And that's in that article, 50 Ways to Optimize Your Natural Testosterone. So yes, okay. Nutrition is huge, is a huge component in reducing estrogen for sure.
Can you give some particulars in terms of nutrition? Are there any specific foods that you want to avoid?
Pretty much anything that's been engineered. And I think the easiest way for your listeners to understand that is if it's in a box and it's on a store shelf, it's pretty much worthless. Those things are so laden with chemicals, byproducts, soy byproducts. There's just, I just use the acronym GMO. I think that's the easiest way to understand it for most people because it's like, been such a popular term now. But I mean, anything that's in a box, that's a box food stuff is pretty much worthless. Great natural estrogen fighting compounds are broccoli. Broccoli has a substance in it called indole-3-carbinol, which is a really powerful I can't think of the term, what it is anyway, but it's very...
Is it an insecticide? No?
No, it's not an insecticide, but it's essentially like a phytoestrogen that will neutralize the body's production of testosterone. Estrogen. If you eat, like a lot of men, like this is an old school tale, but a lot of men who would compete in bodybuilding shows in the 70s always knew that you would eat a ton of broccoli with fish, and that would be all you would eat like in your last 10 days before you would show, because the broccoli with the indole-3-carbinol in broccoli would reduce your estrogen to the point where you would have no ability to have any kind of estrogenic side effects like puffiness or water, a watery retention under the skin or anything like that. So eating a lot of those type of vegetables like green beans, broccoli is the best, kale, spinach, squash, stuff like that. There's a lot of phytoestrogen estrogen fighting compounds in those vegetables and in those foods. And so, you know, eating that kind of stuff is going to keep your estrogen low. And then of course too, you know, having a right balance of essential fatty acids. I mean, I know Ludwig, you guys are involved with the fish oil. I mean, fish oil is huge. You know, omega-3, you know, so many people are deficient in omega-3. If you get 4 to 5 grams of omega-3 every single day in your life, you're going to do a lot of good for yourself.
Great. And then you also mentioned soy as the diametrical opposite. What's wrong with soy? And is all kinds of soy bad for you?
Oh, it's a great question. Almost all soy is bad. There are certain forms of fermented soy. I can't think of what's the sauerkraut. And then there's some other stuff that they sell like in nutritional supplement companies. But most of it is worthless. There's not a lot of science or data, if you go on PubMed or Medline, that shows that eating soy-based compounds lowers men's testosterone levels or anything like that. But again, it's because there's really been no real studies done on that actual component. I mean, most of the stuff that we're seeing like from a soy-related issue is showing up in modern-day society today, so like last 5 to 10 years. But again, there's numerous studies about the endocrine-disrupting chemicals that, you know, are byproducts and part and parcel from soy byproducts. I mean, there's almost everything, like I said, if you take the box food stuff and you analyze it and you break down the constituents, you'll find something in there that is a soy byproduct.
So for example, like these ground beef vegan products made from soy, you wouldn't touch those?
Oh, absolutely not. They're worthless. I wouldn't, you know, that's a whole other conversation. I'm not against being a vegan. I think veganism is great. I feel that, you know, human beings should be pro-choice. I do know about, I do have access to studies that are very, very compartmentalized and very, very few people know about this, but there are certain proteins from animals that the human brain, you know, from a synaptic pathway nourishment standpoint, need. A lot of people who practice like raw veganism have issues about 8 to 10 years after being vegans because they're not getting that specific amino acid that comes from animal protein. Again, I'm not judging people, and you know, there's plenty of people that have been vegans for 30 years that are fine, but there is a component of people that are vegans that start having issues because of the lack of that, you know, amino acid that's found in animals. But no, I think veganism is if you choose to be vegan, I think it's fine. Just don't be getting anything that's processed vegan stuff because again, there's so many nasty chemicals in it.
Okay. Is there any other metric that's important, like another hormone that you can measure? So we have these three measures now: total testosterone, free testosterone, and estrogen. So you have the TE ratio there. Is there anything else?
I mean, there's always, if I had blood work, I could show you, you know, stuff that's important. But for what we're talking about right now, from like a steroid testosterone, therapeutic testosterone measurement, not really. Thyroid levels, which is TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone. And then also looking at like for a clinical thyroid deficiency or something like that. They're all part and parcel. Remember, the hormonal system of the human body is very intricate. So usually when one breaks down, it's likely, or if you have a deficiency in one area, you might have a deficiency in other. There are physicians out there who are brilliant, who look at thyroid levels and look at imbalance in the thyroid. And then that also leads to like a deficient core body temperature, which obviously leads to an inefficiency or an inability to digest food because your body temperature and your metabolism is slowed or delayed. So both of those things are kind of in conjunction with one or the other. But in my experience, again, this is in the book, and please trust for your listeners. I have interviewed, I have six of the world's leading physicians as part of the science team for the book, who have been, majority of them have been prescribing testosterone for over 15 years and are, you know, working with some of the most elite people in the world. So their opinion matters and they have the most clinical experience. They say that if you correct a person's testosterone deficiency, that thyroid tends to work itself out. So again, testosterone, think of testosterone as the lifeblood molecule. It's obviously the sex differentiating molecule between men and women. Women, by the way, and this is also, we have a chapter in the book metabolic for women. Women need testosterone just as much as men. Now, obviously not in the same dosage amount or not in the same amount, you know, to function. But a lot of women are deficient in testosterone in, you know, once they get into their late 30s after a couple kids or even later in their 40s and 50s. You give them testosterone and you do it under, you know, therapeutic guidelines and stuff like that, working with a top physician, they feel amazing.
How about I want to understand the thyroid more. If you're someone who has, for example, subclinical thyroid problems, like what's it called, like Graves' disease? No,
There's a lot of different Crohn's. There's a lot of different things. There's fibromyalgia. There's a lot of different ways they diagnose it now, like subclinical hypothyroidism, and then there's
hypothyroidism. Yeah, that too. Let's say you have that over a longer period of time. How could that influence testosterone levels?
No one really knows. It's a great question. No one really knows. It's kind of like a chicken and egg question, you know, what came first. But both lead to a hormonal imbalance for both pathways. So if you have issues with your thyroid, it's very, very likely you're also going to be testosterone deficient. And obviously testosterone deficiency, ultimately untreated, will lead to some form of thyroid imbalance. Yes.
And testosterone, that's also linked to dopamine, right? Like those two reinforce each other.
Absolutely. So we have in the beginning of the book, and this is why the book, in my opinion, has separated itself from all the other books out there. We talk about what testosterone does in the brain. We talk about memory. We talk about dopamine, you know, what it does to dopaminergic signaling pathways in the brain. Remember, the number one symptom of testosterone deficiency is brain fog / depression. The first mediated response from someone who gets on testosterone optimization therapy is an improvement in mood, an alleviation, if not outright elimination of depression. And again, that's from the dopaminergic signaling. Like you said, the increase in dopamine. It's not something like Adderall or, you know, a stimulant. It's nothing like that because it's not addictive. It's not going to make someone like become dependent. That's the differentiation. Like if you're using a therapeutic dose of testosterone, and clearly you'd have to do it forever, your dopamine response, your energy, all that stuff is going to be better. I wouldn't say like continually heightened, but you're just going to be more sensitive. Your production of dopamine will be more linear. You're going to be like me. You're going to be high energy all the time. You're not going to be like tired, drained, run down. I mean, again, guys, I'm 47. I've been on testosterone for 17 years. And I mean, obviously I'm a shill for it because, you know, it's my life now, but I can't see living any other way. I mean, if you don't need it and you're blessed, and there's plenty of guys that don't. I mean, my father's, you know, 72 years old and he's never been on testosterone and he was a pro athlete and he thinks I'm crazy, right? But, you know, if you do need it, there's no reason in today's society to hide from it or to be shy from it or, you know, regret or consider that, you know, you may be, you know, humiliated by your peers or family or something like that, because there's nothing to hide from. It's a perfectly okay and acceptable form of medicine. I mean, it's like, we say in the book, it's like getting LASIK eye surgery. You know, there's nothing to fear.
And so, what does the actual therapy entail? What do you take and in what forms and how often?
awesome question. It depends. So there's numerous, what we call delivery systems, for therapeutic testosterone. We break down every single one in the book heavily. In my opinion, and this is obviously shared by the doctors who are far smarter than me that I work with, the two most efficient and most convenient, right? Because whenever you look at a man, you have to judge a man based on what will work for his lifestyle, right? We're all different, is injections and then transdermal, which would be through the skin. So it would be applied as either a cream or a gel. There are multiple other systems. There are buccals, which are lozenges that go in the mouth, like that dissolve right in the gum line. There's also patches. There's pellets. They actually surgically implant pellets, which are, in my opinion, medieval and worthless, although there are plenty of men out there that choose to do them. And then there's some new ones. There's like Natesto. And again, all of this is broken down in the book. Natesto is a nasal solution. And by the way, that's horrible because the administration of it is terrible. Guys get headaches. I don't even know why it's even approved. It should be taken off the market. But anyway, there's numerous ways to do it. The two best ways, again, based on lifestyle convenience and based on cost and efficiency are, you know, through the skin, rubbing on a cream or a gel or injections.
And how do you do it?
Good question. I inject. I've always injected. I have tried transdermal. When I first started my therapy with Dr. Scruggs back when I was, you know, literally not 30 years old, a month from turning 30, he had me on injections the first 3 months. And then, and that was at that time, I was only doing one injection a week because we, you know, the science has not evolved to where the, we understood like how to dose it more correctly. We can talk about that if you guys want. But after 3 months, you know, he said, hey, do you want to just, you know, try to do this transdermally? You won't have to inject yourself anymore. And I had no issue with injecting. A lot of men have a massive needle phobia of injecting themselves, which most men overcome after a couple of injections, but some guys just can't do it. So anyway, he said, you want to try the transdermal? And I did. So I tried the transdermal for like 3 months, but I didn't, for me, and again, we're all different. I didn't feel the same as I felt on the injections. I felt on the transdermal, I definitely had a little bit more heightened sex drive because again, when you rub it on your skin, it increases DHT formation, which is dihydrotestosterone, which is one of the chief.
You're not supposed to be rubbing it there.
No, you don't rub it. You don't. You actually, if you can believe it, there are actually idiots out there that were once telling men and women to rub the cream on their vaginal areas, which is definitely retarded.
That would explain the sex drive.
No, well, so it's a good funny point. It's so what happens is when you do it transdermally, it does increase DHT formation, which is again dihydrotestosterone, which is the peak sexual gland functioning hormone of the body. Like dihydrotestosterone is much more, quote unquote, what they call anabolic than even testosterone. So it increases that signal in the brain to say, oh, wow, I'm horny. I want to have sex. But I just felt more, I felt less balanced from the transdermal. And that's, again, very well elucidated and discussed and cited. Again, for your listeners, because you guys have a very highbrow audience, my book has 670 research citations in the book. We did not, every single thing that was ever out there on testosterone, we combed through PubMed and Medline. You know, this is a year of taking all the best research. There's nothing that we substantiate in the book that is not backed up by science and empirically observed. There's no, you know, Jay and, you know, my business partner and my co-author, Jim Brown, say this because we're bros and we've been doing this for 20 years. No, it's all based on science. But I just didn't like the cream because I felt less balanced. And it's also inconvenient, guys. You do have to shave the area that you're applying. And you can't touch loved ones after you do it because there's a possibility of the cream rubbing off on them. And, you know, again, it's transdermal, so it could actually be absorbed by them too. Same thing with animals. So injections to me are the least invasive from a standpoint of screwing up your lifestyle and most efficient because they take less than 10, 15 seconds and you're done.
How many times a week or day or whatever?
Good question. So so in the book, we actually have an entire subchapter dedicated to the most advanced ways to deliver testosterone and the most efficient pattern. And we have literally A, B, and C. And really C is two, but 1A is testosterone injected with an insulin syringe. So literally a hypodermic 31 gauge insulin syringe, like what diabetics take when they inject insulin, at anywhere from 10 to 12 to 13 to 15 milligrams per day. That would be option 1A. And I'll explain the reason you do that, why that's the best option in a second. Option 1B is what I do, which is 3 injections per week. And then option 2, which would kind of be 2A, would be injected once or twice per week. Once per week, even though is efficient, is not optimal because what happens with testosterone is the cleaving of the actual testosterone molecule in the bloodstream, the half-life of most injectable delivery systems is somewhere between 2.5 and 4 days. So what you want to do when you inject, if you're injecting weekly, obviously, you want to inject twice, okay, or more. And I'll talk, I'll just explain it right now. So the more often you inject, two things happen. The closer you're mimicking your body's natural pulsatile testosterone release. So endogenously, you know, your body produces testosterone in little pulses all throughout the day. Most of it, actually, the highest pulse is usually sometime between 4 a.m. and 6:30 in the morning. That's why men wake up with morning wood. So if you take testosterone in a very micro, you know, use the Tim Ferriss, the minimum effective dosage principle, the MED principle, every single day, you're less likely to have any kind of disturbance or imbalance to your body's production or noticing of the exogenous form of testosterone. So the body just kind of takes it as, oh, this is natural. So you don't have any side effects. You don't have a feeling of like, oh my God, I'm imbalanced. You know, I feel moody. I feel irritable. The next best thing would be like what I do, which is 3 times a week. I don't inject every day for me. If I could, I would, but it's just not efficient for my life. I don't do it every single morning, but I know hundreds of men, you know, around the world who do. And there are great physicians out there that highly recommend that too, because they actually will compound a testosterone formulation that also has vitamin D in it, vitamin E, sometimes a specific type of B vitamin. So there's lots of ways to do it, but you want to do it more than once a week, because getting back to that half-life of testosterone, you want to make sure that you never have a trough. So if the half-life is say 2.5 days of testosterone cypionate or testosterone amphenate, you want to make sure that right when you give yourself the next injection, you're about to come down, so that the next injection kind of, if you're looking at it like on a trial to peak, you know, level across a linear timeline of 7 days, you would never have a bottom. You would always kind of be in the midline. So, you know, you're going to have a peak after you inject, and that's going to be up to 36 hours. And then it starts to slowly drop, you know, from a half-life standpoint. So then your next injection is timed so that you are hitting the drop so that you never have a bottom. Does that make sense?
Yeah. How about downsides or like addiction?
There's no addiction to testosterone. That's a myth. Now, we're talking about therapeutic testosterone. There's clearly dopamine issues for using, you know, anabolic steroids, super physiologic dosages of testosterone, you know, the bro community, the bodybuilding community. What we're talking about here is nothing like that. You know, we're talking about very, very low clinical therapeutic dosage of testosterone, never to exceed 250 milligrams a week of exogenous testosterone. So for me, I'd never in my entire life of 17 years being on test, I've never used more than 175 milligrams a week. Now, sometimes it's normally 150, which is 3 shots of 50 milligrams each. But, you know, who knows, because I'm obviously, you know, I've worked with different doctors. I've used different testosterones. I've used testosterone propionate, which is a shorter half-life than anthate and cypionate. So I always say if I'm doing 3 shots a week, it's somewhere between 150 and 175 milligrams. Again, just because I know that, you know, there's a little differentiation in the actual estrogen.
And over these 17 years, have you had to adjust the dosage much, I guess, to the upside?
No, it's a great question. It's a great question. Very minimally. But we do talk about in the book, that's a great question, by the way, Mikhail. We do say this in the book. You, as you age and you do this productively, and obviously, hopefully, under the guidance and care of a great physician, you are definitely going to have to pay attention to your biomarkers. You've got to have to understand, you know, the changes that undergo in your body. I did the only thing that's ever happened to me negatively, in 17 years. And again, this is very, very clearly and authentically, stated in the book, in the chapter on gynecomastia. I had a very mild form, in my right nipple that just appeared out of nowhere in the very beginning of 2015. I tried to use medications to suppress it, you know, prescribed by my doctor, which at the time was Dr. Brett Osborne. You know, he's a very famous neurological surgeon with an amazing book, Get Serious. And we were not able to cure it. And here's the thing with gyno, and we'll talk a little bit about this right now, because it's obviously a topic that affects, I'm not exaggerating, hundreds of millions of men around the world. And most of the men that it affects are untreated because they're embarrassed, humiliated, ashamed. The chapter in the book on gynecomastia actually is interviewing the world's number one surgeon for gyno replacement or gyno removal. And that's the physician that I worked with. His name is Dr. Joseph Cruz. He's in Newport Beach in Beverly Hills. And he, you know, he's world renowned. He's literally done more than 3,000 surgeries. And the guy's amazing. And he understands like the actual essence of the surgery and how to remove the duct and all these things. But that's the only thing that I got. And, you know, there's no, again, very well explained in the book, there's no etiology or causation that we can specifically say. I mean, the smartest guys in the world, when they talk about gyno, they'll tell you that it's stress related. It could be, you know, cortisol related. It could be obviously hormonally related. There's so many issues. It could be nutritionally related. There's so many issues that can kind of convene and converge to lead one to have it. I do know that at the time in my life that I had it, I was going through massive stress. It was right before I published my first book, the TRT manual. It was when I was with Mike Cernovich, and I were partnered in a lot of different ways. And we were stressing each other out over like which way and which directions to go. So I personally believe that mine was caused by stress. It wasn't anything that I did hormonally, because nothing really deviated, than what I'd always done. So, you know, back to your question, it's a really good question. I've stayed between 150 and 175 milligrams for almost 17 years because I've just never seen a need to do any more or to do any less. I feel great at that level.
And just a little bit off topic, but have you had any issues with traveling with your syringes?
That is an awesome question. Thank you for asking it. No, I will say this, that in certain countries that are, you know, ignorant, that's the best word, of people that are on, you know, clinical therapeutic testosterone prescriptions, I would definitely not bring it in my on my carry-on. I would not have it go through metal detectors. Now, I do know hundreds of stories of men that have. If you do go through carry-on, you don't check the bag. And I'll talk about how I carry my stuff with me because I travel the world often. I would definitely make sure that it's in a plastic bag with your holographic seal from your physician, you know, with the prescription, the RX label, or, you know, some sort of holographic seal that shows why you have, a couple of needles with, an oily solution in them. But I do know men that have been pulled aside, you know, through security at airports. And never, as long, it's like anything, right? If you get pulled over by a policeman anywhere in the world, as long as you're professional, you're tactful, you look them in the eye, you're respectful and polite, no sir, yes sir, you know, no ma'am, yes ma'am. It's very rare if you have an intelligent explanation. Look, I have a prescription for testosterone. Here it is. You know, I carry it with me, blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's very, very rare that you're going to have some asshole, you know, that's going to F with you and pull you aside and make you, you know, have to go through the grilling. I actually have only heard one person in the whole world in 10 years that's had an issue. But I also know that that person's an asshole. So I probably figured that that's why it happened. So how I travel with them, I'm sorry, I left that off. I carry my hygiene bag and I always put it in my, my checked baggage, and I just put it in the same thing, carry it in a bag with my prescription in it. And I'll usually carry, if I'm traveling for more than 10 days, I'll bring 3 injections. And I'll just have it in there and it's in my hygiene bag, and I've never, ever once been stopped or asked or anything.
Okay. Right now we're pretty much out of time. And is there anything else that we should bring up before that?
No, I think you guys hit everything, man. I think this was awesome interview.
We talked about your book or books actually, and we'll put them in the show notes, and your email address. We'll supply that as well. And do you have a website?
Yes. So the website is, I have a couple, but the main website is TOT, so Testosterone Optimization Therapy Revolution.com. That's my main site. You know, I have a bunch of people that write for that site, and that site is getting currently 21,000 unique visitors a month. I do have a couple other ones, but that's my main site.
Final thing, perhaps the most practical thing for most people to do is do your blood work at least once per year. And if you find out that you have high estrogen, if you can do that, we can't do that in Sweden, but if you can do that, like in other countries, then try to reduce your estrogen levels if they're very high.
100%. Testosterone optimization therapy should always be the last ditch effort and not even attempted until you've tried to optimize through natural means first.
Great way to end that. Thank you so much, Jay.
Thank you, guys. I truly appreciate you having me on.
So there you have it. Probably the most important takeaway from this episode is that if you have deficient testosterone levels or elevated estrogen levels as a man, then the most important thing is to reduce those estrogen levels. And then, as Jay has been saying, we'll put his email in the description, so you can just check the episode description if you want to get the book from him. And then also, we'll also link to the studies there, the Hebrew studies and the articles that he's been referencing. Also, if you want to get weekly summaries of our episodes, very practical, very good, very appreciated, sent out to many thousands of people each week, then you can head over to www.futureskillspodcast.com, or you can check the link in description for that too. And then you'll get these really practical summaries of every episode that we do. That's all we have for today. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.